So if you've ever said, I did what I had to do, but it doesn't sit right with me, this episode is for you. Because sometimes it's not stress or burnout or even trauma, it's something deeper. And today we're going to be talking about it. Dr. Carter Czech is here. He's a clinical chaplain, healthcare ethicist, professor, and the author of Healing in the Wild. And he focuses on something that most people literally don't talk about, moral injury, that heavy feeling you carry after you've made a decision, witnessed something, or done something that goes against your core values. And today we're going to break it down in a way that everyone can understand. Dr. Carter, it's so good to have you here. Thank you for being here today.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me. And it is a really important conversation to have. So I'm excited for the platform to share. And hopefully someone out there hears something today that resonates with them, that gives them the ability to move forward. And so let's do it.
Let's do it. I guess to start out simple, what is moral injury?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so, when a person hears the word moral injury, I think it's important that we deconstruct language for a second, because when most people hear the word moral, they think religious. And in deconstructing the language, let me do this. I work in the context of veterans and first responders who have, really suicide prevention. And I would say that moral injury work is upstream suicide prevention. And so when you're talking to people about trauma, there's a word that we use all the time, Lisa, and this is the best word to use to describe this deconstructing language moment, okay? It's the word trigger. If I lined up 1,000 veterans outside of my clinic and I asked them, "What's your trigger?" I bet you my paycheck, every single one of them is going to give me something negative. But here's the thing. Are all triggers negative? No, they're not. Some
No.
triggers are very positive. But when we build a box of care, and I think it comes from being so symptom-driven that we miss people. When we build a box and we're like, "Hey, what's your trigger?" And then we come at that box with a negative connotation ourselves, well, how are the ones we're caring for going to be able to have a distinction? And so
Right.
when you say the word moral injury, what I want to say is that's an injury to whatever you would personally, and personally is important because remember, we're talking about language. So it's less important the language I want you to have than me lining up with the language you're bringing to me. Because if I'm over here talking about something and I'm not even understanding where you're coming from, I'm missing you. And that is so important when we talk about something like moral injury, okay? So when we're talking about that language, it would be whatever you would personally conceptualize as being morally healthy. So that injury is an injury to that construct. So let me give one major clarifying distinction, and then I'm going to do my best to tackle moral injury. Trauma threatens safety. Moral injury threatens meaning. So trauma would ask the person usually, especially if we're talking about post-traumatic stress, and that is usually many people that suffer post-traumatic stress are highly likely to have a moral injury involved, okay? But trauma asks the question, am I safe? Moral injury asks the question, who am I now? And it is possible to survive an event physically and still feel internally disoriented. Like something once coherent no longer feels trustworthy. So you may not even have the language for it. You just simply feel altered. So rather than trying to define moral injury in a single sentence, it's better to understand it as a wound to the conscience. So what happens is when something you did, maybe something you failed to prevent, maybe something you failed to do, or something that was done to you collides with your deepest sense of right and wrong. And the injury is not primarily fear-based, it's value-based. And it's a distress that follows when your moral framework is shaken or fractured or betrayed. So moral injury is not weakness. And in many cases, It's the very evidence that your moral core is still intact.
Interesting.
The pain you feel is a signal that your conscience is alive. I mean, if you didn't have morals, you wouldn't care, right? And
Yeah.
the suffering comes from caring deeply about what is right and discovering that reality did not align with the conviction that you had, okay? So instead of asking, what is moral injury? It may be more helpful to ask, where has my sense of right, trust, and identity been wounded? And that question opens space for understanding without reducing the experience to like a label. So I hesitate to define moral injury narrowly. I prefer to describe it as a wound to the conscience. And it just
I think so.
basically,
An example that's coming up for me, and this is like super personal. Back when I was younger, I remember being intimate with someone, but I crossed the line in that intimacy. Like I told myself I wasn't going to be intimate with someone until I felt a certain way, and you know, I wouldn't just sleep with someone right off the bat. And I remember it happened. And in the moment, I just let it go. But after, I was like traumatized because it went against everything that I was representing and wanted to represent. So is that an example of a moral injury?
Yeah, I think so. Look, there's injuries that leave scars. Okay. Most of us have them. I've got one on my forehead. Okay. And then there are injuries that alter the way you see yourself.
Right.
Some wounds bleed, others remain internal, and those wounds start to reshape identity quietly. So here's the sneaky thing is you can still continue functioning. You can lead, you can serve, you can believe, and you can even thrive externally while something beneath the surface still feels misaligned. And so we're not merely talking about trauma, because when people talk about trauma, most of the time they're talking about the type of trauma that's rooted in fear. What we're naming here is different. It's a fracture that occurs when experience collides with conviction. So when it's what you did or witnessed or failed to prevent starts to strain the moral architecture that once held you steady, that once made you confident, right? Focusing on symptoms alone will miss the type of wound because it isn't visible in scans or detected by measurements alone. And many people, they feel this type of pain and assume the problem is like a personal deficiency, right? They'll conclude that, well, if the shame is persistent, then I must be defective as a person. But often the pain, it's not evidence of the corruption, like even what you're talking about, right? It's evidence of conscience. And
Yeah.
so today, we're not trying to fix anything. We're trying to name something because naming it helps restore dignity before it restores the strength. Follow me?
So I guess the feeling is I did what I had to do, but it doesn't feel right. So I know so many people, like leaders, parents, caregivers, first responders, who've had those moments where they thought exactly that. Is that
Yeah.
where the moral injury begins?
Yes. And that's kind of a part of it. There's this burden of silence, okay? Most people don't speak about this type of pain because it feels like failure. So if you feel shame or you assume you're the cause of it, if you feel estranged from your former self or like, gosh, I'm not who I used to be, you assume you've fallen and you're beyond repair. But silence compounds that distortion. So
Right.
what's unnamed starts to become exaggerated. And what is accompanied that becomes isolating, right? And we know, listen, the worst two risk factors anybody could ever be involved in are isolation and loneliness. And loneliness is the worst because even, not all isolation is bad. Sometimes we need solitude. Sometimes we need to get away, collect our thoughts, a moment to breathe, right? But loneliness is different, Lisa. Loneliness is introspective. You can't look across a room and see who's lonely. But when I did my doctoral work, I did a meta-analysis on 94 different research projects that connected loneliness to suicidality. And what I found is loneliness is what we call a motivational phase factor. Think about throwing gas on a fire. Combustion, right? That's what happens when someone enters into loneliness. And what I mean about loneliness is I mean you're surrounded by people, but you still feel alone. That type of
I was
loneliness,
just gonna say there's so many different kinds, because sometimes I have a million friends around me, but I still feel alone.
And so moral injury deepens when it's carried alone. And not because the wound grows larger, but because the imagination that we have grows narrower. And this is where presence is so important, right? Because healing begins when someone hears the story without correcting it, not solving it, not spiritualizing it, simply witnessing it. I would say presence is the best medicine, right?
Yeah. So what you're saying is, if we continue to hold these things inside because of the shame and guilt, then we're going to continue feeling alone in the world because we're caught up in those experiences. They make us feel uneasy, unwell. And how can that translate and show up in the body?
Oh, so listen, moral injury isn't just guilt, right? A lot of people feel guilt, maybe that's moral injury. Guilt is a part of the experience, okay? But moral injury is not reducible to guilt. Guilt says I did something wrong. Moral injury says what happened has altered how I see myself and how I see the world. So it involves conscience, identity, and meaning, your values, right? When I encounter someone who's really suffered a morally injurious event, some of the first things to go is trust, competence, autonomy, identity, right? So when your moral world fractures, the pain's not only about behavior, it's about coherence, right? So guilt can be resolved through confession or repair. And when you hear the word confession, I don't mean like you're going behind the screen and a priest is talking to you, because a lot of times when people hear the word confession, they think this terrible thing is happening on the other side of it. And that's not what I'm talking about. The first movement toward restoration is not repentance or reform or even reframing. It's just honesty. Honesty with yourself. Honesty before God, if you're a person of theistic faith, okay? And honesty is the presence of another human being who can hold what you're saying without recoiling. They can hold what you're saying without, use the poker face, right? And the fact that you feel moral pain, that's not proof that you're irredeemable. It's proof that something within you still recognizes goodness, right? And that recognition is not weakness. It's moral strength under strain. So, what do you feel in your body? That was the question you asked. I think normally you'll feel this shame, you'll feel this helplessness, you'll feel this hopelessness, you'll feel this unworthiness, and that can show up as tension in your body. It can show up as a lot of times it can show up maybe. If we're talking about symptomology, like things of anxiety or depression, people ask me all the time, well, what should someone do? Well, I think here's the number one thing you do. Find one person who can hear the truth without trying to manage you. That's it. You need someone to show up. It's why I wrote the book Healing in the Wild, right? About nature, because when we're suffering, we need someone to show up. And when you can't depend on anybody to show up, guess what? Nature always shows up. I know you know, Lisa, you have some place out in nature that you're drawn to, whether it's daily or monthly or yearly. It's some place that you think about. And when you're sitting in that spot, when you're witnessing whatever happens, whether it's by a creek side or a mountaintop or a sunset or a sunrise, something happens different for you in those moments. I know my spot, you know your spot. Everybody has one, right? And so the thing about nature is all you got to do is show up. Nature will do its part.
Yeah, 100%. So something coming up for me, Dr. Carter, is another personal situation in my 20s again. I'm in my 40s now, so this is 20
Come
years
on.
ago. I remember working in a place that what I was doing to make money sometimes didn't feel morally right because the people around me weren't, they didn't have integrity, they weren't acting, authentically. And because I was working in that space and indirectly involved, I was working for them. That was my way of making money and supporting myself and allowing my bills to be paid. And so it was a feeling of, I have to do what I have to do, but I also felt stuck. What can you speak to that, and what advice or what would you say? Like, how can we figure out situations like that where we feel like, if I leave the situation, I don't know how I'm going to be able to support myself.
Yeah, look, if you've been carrying something that you could not name, and today, like you're having this, hey, I'm curious about this. Or maybe someone's listening and they're like, yeah, I resonate with that too. Here's the thing. Today you recognized it. And recognition matters. That matters. And here's the most important thing. You're not weak for feeling fractured. You're not weak for feeling like, wow, maybe that went against my nature, right? And you're not alone because you feel ashamed of it. You're not beyond restoration because you felt like something inside you was different or broke because you were under pressure. You're still here. That matters, okay? The simple recognition of being able to have the courage and the vulnerability to talk about it, that's super, super important, okay? So a lot of people say, like, how do you personally reconcile your faith with moral injury, right? Because I hear a little bit of that. So I do not see faith as denial of a fracture. I see faith as the space where fracture can be held without final condemnation. Like faith doesn't erase the memory. Faith, here's we're talking about something from 20 years ago with you, Lisa, right? Faith doesn't erase the memory of that or even kind of like the moral complexity of it, but it allows memory to exist inside mercy rather than inside self-judgment. That's important, right? Because the tragic part is a lot of moral injury leads to suicide. Because moral injury can intensify isolation and shame. And when someone believes they become irredeemable or burdensome, or, I don't have a place in the world, then the risk increases. And the pain, it's not just emotional. Now it becomes existential, right? Risk is not destiny. Connection and language and presence, those things reduce that isolation significantly. So when you get around people and just the opportunity to kind of talk it out without someone trying to fix you, if you take the word treat patience in Latin, the word treat means to drag, and a patient is a passive long-term sufferer. So if my goal when I encounter you is to treat you, to fix you, basically what I'm doing is I'm dragging along a passive long-term sufferer. Now, I don't know about you, but that doesn't sound very empowering, does it?
No,
But
definitely not.
if you take the word companion, okay, calm is with, but what I want you to think of is breaking bread with someone, right? And that's the type of relationship, that's the type of environment an individual needs to really heal from moral injury. You don't need someone to try and fix you. You don't need someone to try and, heal you. What you need is someone to sit with you, right?
Well, there's
Because a
something
lot
that
of people,
shuts me down when I talk to someone and I open up and suddenly they're giving me all the solutions in the world. It makes me feel worse,
what I'm not, you don't need advice. You need presence, right? There are a lot of people, of course, as a clinical chaplain, I work with a lot of people who do have faith with God, right? And I work with a lot of people who don't. And a lot there, and there's a question that I get often. It's like, if God forgives, well, why would moral injury remain? Why would I still feel, something from 20, 40 years ago, right? So Let me say this. Theologically, forgiveness may be declared. Psychologically and morally, integration still takes time. So forgiveness addresses guilt before God, but moral injury addresses identity within the self and the community, right? Usually moral injury keeps you from community. You know, the shame doesn't want you to be around other people. So one can believe in forgiveness and still struggle to reconcile who they have become through what they've experienced. So faith is not erased by moral injury. Faith does not bypass formation either. So healing is often the process of allowing forgiveness to become embodied rather than just merely affirmed, right? We're always becoming, and we should always be learning. Whether it's you remembering something from your past and being in that environment and thinking back, well, like, wow, you know, that just the simple recognition of that, Lisa, lets me know one very important thing. You care. Your values matter.
So,
If you were a
Dr. Carter,
sociopath or a psychopath, they wouldn't matter, would they?
that's true. That's true. Well, I guess my next question would be, why is it so important to name it and to say it out loud? Why is that such an important part in the healing process?
Because shame does something very powerful. It does its best to silence our narrative. It does its best to just keep you quiet, keep you in your own head. Don't share about anybody because my God, if you share this with them, you know, how's that going to affect your relationship with them going forward, right? So you better just keep your mouth quiet. And so shame is really tricky in that aspect. Look, if shame can't get you to be quiet because it just wants you to be isolated and away from community, away from people who can wrap their arms around you and not judge you, if it can't get you to just stay away for that reason, it'll get you to stay away because it'll make you think, well, don't share this because if you share this, you might hurt somebody else. Like you might re-traumatize or you might, you know, negatively trigger someone else, right? So it causes you to stay silent. And silence, listen, when we're silent, we're not in community. When we're silent, we're not in relationship. So silence is a dangerous thing. Look, for those who understand the Christian faith or even the you know the Judeo-Christian faith, when God created everything, he called it good. But there was one thing that displeased him, that man was alone. So created a woman so that there could be relationship. And when and in that story in the garden, when sin entered, do you know the first thing that entered? Shame.
They're gonna say,
Shame.
oh, shame. Okay.
Shame. And so silence and shame are terrible things to have to deal with, right? God asked the question, where are you to Adam and Eve? Like, hey, where are you? Do you think God didn't know where they were? But in that moment, this is when they started to cover their nakedness. This is where they started to be defensive. This is where they started to, you know, that shame caused them to see things different. And the only way that shame can be busted up is when you name it and you start to restore community in the process.
The one thing for me, I know in the past, again, drawing from past experiences, is that I had a fear of speaking my truth out loud only simply because I felt that if I shared it and I said it out loud, that would mean that I would have to do something about it and take responsibility for it. So it's like, scary because it's like, if I say this out loud, like now I actually have to start changing, if that makes sense. Do you know what I mean? It's
No,
like you speak
it
it out
totally
loud, it becomes
does.
real.
Yeah, it totally does. It makes, yeah, and I'm glad you said that because naming something matters because silence, it magnifies distortion. So
Right.
when a person can't articulate what they've been experiencing, right, the mind will fill itself with explanations that are often really harsh and inaccurate, like I'm broken, I'm weak, I'm a monster, I'm dangerous, I don't belong here. And that's just the ones that come right off the top of my head from working with people who have been suffering in the space. So without language, pain becomes your identity. So if you're silent, then pain starts to become your identity. And so what naming does is it really interrupts that process and it separates the wound from the person. Man, that's so important, Lisa, right? Because moral injury in particular is frequently misinterpreted as pathology. So someone assumes they're unstable when in fact they're just grieving a value violation. You know, there was a violation of something that was right to me. And so they assume they're defective when all they're doing is just really wrestling with conscience. So when we name the experience accurately, I think what we do is we restore proportion and we move from self-condemnation to now understanding what we went through. Naming it also restores agency. I'm so glad you asked that question. And agency is so important because many times what shame does is it steals your agency from you because it makes you silent. So what can't be described in an exam or you can't see on a scan, right? Once a person can say, this is a wound to my conscience, they're no longer drowning in something vague or overwhelming, they're actually facing something specific, and specific wounds can be addressed. Look, I was an Army Cav Scout, and one thing's for sure, if you get shot and you can't find the wound that you're bleeding out of, you're gonna die. It's really important to be able to locate the wound, right? And so that's the danger of these unseen wounds. It's naming it allows you to like address it. And then there's also, listen, there's also this relational dimension that I was talking about. Many people who carry moral injury feel alone because they lack a shared language. So when the experience is named, all of a sudden it becomes speakable. And someone else will be like, oh yeah, I've experienced that too. And what is speakable can now be accompanied or walked along with, right? Because listen, if there's one thing I know about shame, is shame thrives in isolation, invites connection back. Tell it and have someone present. Invited. Now, naming doesn't solve the wound. It does something quieter but foundational. It stabilizes your reality. It tells the person, look, this has shape, it has contours, but it's not all of who you are. And once that boundary is drawn, then healing can start to begin.
It almost empowers you, right? Like you say it out loud and then someone can relate to it and you don't feel alone anymore. And then it gives you strength back in order to move forward from it. So in those situations where I've
100%.
said things out loud, yeah, it gives you power. Because it's like it gets out of your body.
Yes. Yes, 100%. And that's one of those things that when you're suffering, you need to be seen. You need community. Moral injury is an injury that separates you from community. And that's why it's so important, like in a lot of the work that we do with veterans and first responders specifically, and look, moral injury is a human thing, not a vet and first responder thing, but it's my context of what I work with. But the reason we have group work and not individual work is because the communal aspect of it is important to heal the wound. The wound happens, and it makes you feel like it separates you from society, that it separates you from the good people. I'm a bad person, so I can't be around good people, right? That's one of the lies and the deceptions of shame. You're terrible. You're unworthy.
So, Dr. Card, I want to ask you about your book. So, your book is called Healing in the Wild, which is not a typical therapy title. So, why the wild? What happens to people when they step into the wild or nature?
Well, the first thing is what I shared a little bit earlier, right? Nature always shows up. And so that's one of the most important pieces. When the wild isn't just, when people hear healing in the wild, they often assume that it's just about the scenery. The wild is not a backdrop, it's the context. And most moral wounds form in environments of intensity or compression, and many times consequence, right? Like I'm in a consequential situation. I'm going to call it noise, right? You know, we're surrounded by noise all the time. And it's what we deal with. And usually there's urgency and there's adrenaline. Well, afterward, many return to environments that are equally compressed in a different way. Screens, schedules, expectations, performance. Woo, that's a good one, right? And so this is a very little space to really kind of metabolize what was carried home from your traumatic situation where moral injury came. So listen, the wild creates space. Out there, wherever that is for you, okay? Out there, no one is impressed by your resume.
No.
No one's asking, no one's asking what you achieved. The rocks aren't, the terrain doesn't reward performance. It simply invites presence. And that shift matters. So when a person's no longer required to manage perception, something internal begins to soften. The nervous system begins to slow, the mind unclenches. And then conscience has room to speak without being drowned out. So here's the thing. The wild is also honest. Look, we need space and we need honesty. Weather changes, Lisa. Lights fade. But fire requires tending, right? Water has to be found in the wild. Like, you're just sitting there and you go over to the sink and you got to find water. So nature doesn't flatter or condemn. What it does is it reveals. So that kind of environment really mirrors the inner work of moral healing. And you can't force the process, but you can create conditions where it unfolds with integrity. And there's another reason. Many who carry moral injury feel alienated from themselves. And what the wild does is it introduces embodiment. Walking in the cold air, building a fire, tracking movement in silence. I'm a hunter, so maybe you're tracking in silence, right? And those are all acts that ground you. You have to be super intentional. Like you can't be thinking about your calendar when you're looking for wood to build a fire. And so you reconnect thought and body, and healing is rarely achieved through cognition alone. It requires some type of rhythm, some type of movement or tangible effort, right? I mean, you were talking about yoga earlier. You understand, right? There's this movement and rhythm and effort that you have to get involved with, right? And the wild also, this might be one of the most important people. It restores proportion. What I mean is, under an open sky, shame doesn't disappear, but it shrinks to the human scale. And the horizon widens perspective. Like you can't sit on top of a mountain and look and not have this different type of perspective. So you're reminded that you're part of something larger than the worst moment of your life. And that reminder, it's not sentimental, it's stabilizing. So healing in the wild is not, it's not about escape. And it's not just about encounter. It's about encounter with silence, with conscience, with your grief, with God for those open to that dimension, right? And eventually encounter with the self that survived That's important. Look, the wild doesn't heal you. What it does is it creates the conditions where healing is more likely to occur. That is why the wild.
Yeah. So what about you use the word companioning? What does companioning mean in simple terms?
So I know that you've lived long enough to have leadership, different leaders, right? And you've had leaders that have sat across the desk from you, and you've had leaders who have come around the desk and sat with you, right?
Yeah, 100%.
And it's not a trick question for me to ask you which leader you prefer. I already know which leader you prefer.
Yeah.
That's the best way for me to describe companioning. Companioning is not about me trying to fix you. I genuinely don't have a predetermined journey I believe people need to go on when I encounter them. Companioning is about meeting them where they are and helping them be the best version of themselves. Because the reality is, we need to be the expert of our own lives. If we have to depend on other people all the time, now look, I know there are certain conditions, health reasons, where we 100% have to depend on other people. Okay. So move those people aside. I'm not talking about people who are connected to machines and all of those types of stuff or don't have the ability to walk on their own or none of that. I'm talking about everyday, ordinary folks, right? That have the, God has graced them with the ability to not have to solely depend on something, right? Those folks. It's better in life if you're the expert of your own life, because if you need me every time something goes south, well, what if I'm not available? What if you can't get me? Then what are you going to do? And so companioning is not just about walking with someone, helping them walk with them, right? With bread, it's like breaking bread. It's more about fellowship than relationship. Let me explain that. I've got a natural brother, same blood, same parents, 5 years older than me. And we haven't really fellowshipped in probably 8 years. He's busy doing his own life. I'm doing mine. And the distance of growing up, in the age differences, we were never close anyways. He was always doing his own thing, and I was the younger one doing my own thing. And I don't want you to hear, in my talk, like, this deep regret or hurt is, I don't really feel like I lost anything because I never really had fellowship with my brother. Now we're related, but we don't fellowship. And I have friends that I've had for my entire life that are closer than what people would consider a brother because I fellowship with. That's companioning. It's not just relationship. It's walking with someone in such a way that you're not there to fix them. You're there to just support what they need. I want someone to be the expert of their own life. And again, I feel like that's what nature does when we don't have that. And so when I look back in my life, and it's kind of the birth of like where that came from, Lisa, is it makes sense now. When I was a young boy and my brother didn't want to play with me because I was little and, loud and stupid and all that I'd go ride my bike through the woods, right? I would go find opportunities in nature to be my friend. And so, as I look back in my life now, the importance of archery and sports and those types of things have a different type of meaning because it's what I needed in those seasons to feel connected to something. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. One thing that I've noticed is that I feel like the strongest people, the most capable, they're the ones that are often carrying the most unseen moral weight. Why do you think that is?
Well, I believe that when you're a person who feels like you're designed to care for other people, then you feel you're okay with carrying other people's burdens, right? I'm one of those individuals. Look, in my profession, I walk with people who have some of the most trauma-filled stories. I mean, just stories that when you hear them, you can't help but feel like, wow. And when I was a resident in Atlanta working at the VA hospital, I lived next to a cemetery. And it was a big cemetery, like one of those that you get to get in your car and drive across. I mean, it's big.
Okay.
And I experienced the same type of thing. Anytime I go to DC, and I was just there recently, and I go to Arlington. Some people see the headstones and they think, wow, that's a lot of loss. I see them and I think there's a lot of opportunities to help people before they get there.
Right.
And so it's just it's a different mindset. And why am I sharing this? I'm sharing this because if you're out there and you're one of those people that care for other people in diverse contexts where you carried stories and burdens vicariously, traumas, things like that, take care of yourself. Like you have to have a super intentional self-care plan because if you don't, you will become a statistic. One of the craziest statistics I've ever come alongside in my work as a suicide prevention specialist is suicide survivors, those that are left after someone close to them dies by suicide. They're 175% more likely to die by suicide. So when a mom
Wow.
takes her life, her daughter, her son is more likely to. And if you think back in your life of people that you've been connected to that have died by suicide, you'll see that pattern is true. Here's the other thing. There are 135 people directly connected to every suicide death. Whether it was your barista at the coffee shop or, a teacher or whatever that is. And so those types of traumatic losses, if we don't have places to process and unpack them, they can start to be a weight that we weren't meant to carry. So a lot of people ask me, Lisa, how do you handle it when you lose a veteran to suicide? Right? I work on a suicide prevention team. I think to date, this year, my team has lost around 14 veterans.
Wow.
So here's the thing. They say, how do you handle that? Well, here's what I do. I have to honor the way they decided to go. I don't like it. Don't hear that. I don't like it. But if I don't honor their decision, then I'm holding on to something and taking that into an opportunity where someone might want to live. Okay. There is a passion that I carry in my work. And it's one of the reasons that even after I did my doctoral work at Vanderbilt, I decided, you know what? I'm going to go get a research degree. So I'm like a class away from a PhD in healthcare ethics. And the reason I did that is I really feel moral injury is more an ethical issue than anything else. And so in that work, I started getting into the conceptualizing moral health, and I'm not going to go deep into that. But what drove me there was this. All of the statistical data that we have around suicide death operates off the CDC, and it's 2 years old. So we're working off of 2-year-old data to handle the crisis of suicide death in America. Okay. Now, what I don't want you to hear in this moment is that that's not important data. It's super important. But I have this sneaky suspicion that data on what caused people to die isn't as important on data that has helped people to live. And so, as a suicide prevention specialist, I can step in the gap and hopefully mitigate suicide deaths and stop people from dying. But if I don't show them reasons to live, then I'm just going to keep stopping them from trying to die. So, what I really want is I wanted a degree where I could be a primary investigator in research initiatives and start to get data from the people who 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 40 years ago wanted to kill themselves. And here they are living, they're thriving, they're flourishing as a human, they've been resilient. Why? What have you been doing? Because I really feel like that type of data will help more people live, right? There's this story, and maybe you've heard it before, but back in World War II, the engineers were looking at the airplanes that they were using for the bombing runs. And they were looking at where the airplanes had been shot to try and reinforce the areas on that plane where they wouldn't have catastrophic failure. Because here's the thing, if a plane goes down, it can't deliver a bomb, right? And so they started
That's
looking at it.
funny.
They're like, so let's reinforce the wings. Let's put some more reinforcement around the engine compartment. And one of the engineers on the team said, all of this is great, but we're missing a data set. Where's the data from the planes that actually did have catastrophic failure and were shot down? We don't know where they were hit. And that's what I'm talking about when I talk about this data around suicide death. We've got this one strain, it's 2 years old, and it's what leads to death. But where's all the data that leads to life, that has caused people to not blow their brains out, not overdose, not hang themselves in a tree? I think that data is super important. That type of data is the type of data that those of us that are in these care professions, that experience burnout, that experience moral injury from caring for others and not knowing like where to put it. It's important because we need to know about resiliency and human flourishing and all that. I have a mentor who has been very formidable in my life in all of this work. His name is Dr. Keith Metter. And Dr. Metter says, he made a statement one time, and he said, the greatest movement that an individual can make in their life is usually to take unbearable pain and turn it to livable disappointment. Now, I know livable disappointment doesn't sound like much of a prize, Lisa, unless it's weighed against unbearable pain. And that is the tension of working in a field where you're experiencing unbearable pain from other people all the time. And, you know, look, I have two therapists. I have one that I work with and my stuff. I said earlier I was a Cav Scout. I deal with my own stuff. And then I have one that I process the stories that I do from work, because it's not like I can go sit with my wife on the couch and be like, hey, babe, let me tell you about this person that, you
Yeah,
know.
can be traumatic
Right.
for
It's,
her.
yeah, 100%. And it's not that you don't, might not have those types of relationships in your life, but why would you want to bring that to them? Right. So, look, self-care. We could probably do a whole nother series or podcast on self-care alone, but that's really the heart behind healing in the wild. It's one of the reasons that I looked. When I started to think about what did I want to write about in my doctoral work that I felt would be the pinnacle of the message that if I died tomorrow, I would want to leave with the universe. And it was a model of self-care that wasn't connected to religious institutions, not that I'm not a person of faith, but that wasn't connected to religious institutions where people could say, oh no, that's connected to that, and I don't believe, and that wouldn't help me. I wanted to deliver something that could meet anybody where they were, suffering from unseen wounds and significant loss, disenfranchised grief, ambiguous loss, and not just meet them where they were, but give them practical tools and takeaways that they could find relief. And you know what? Understand that as long as you're still here, you get to write how your story ends. Nobody writes it for you until you give away your pen and your agency to someone, for someone else to write it.
Absolutely. So, Dr. Carter, I'd love to, end this episode with some hope. So, tell us more about the work that you do, and is moral injury something that people need to learn to live with, or is it something that can truly be restored?
Yeah, great question. Yes, 100%. It's something that can be restored, because the only time it can't be restored is when we hold it in and we don't talk about it. And that's the reality of it. I don't want it to seem so simplistic, you know, but it really is that simple. You know, it's that simple. Don't leave it in a closet. Don't, you know, unseen grave, you know, unmarked graves are graves that we still know where it is, what we buried, and we're just hoping other people don't stumble upon them. But
Right.
once you can make an unmarked grave marked, it no longer has power over you. It no longer has the ability to feel like this hidden thing in your life, right? And so what do I do? I really work at the intersection of moral injury, grief and loss, and spiritual care. And when I say spiritual care, I don't want you to just think it's another word, right? Like trigger, like moral. I don't want you to think spiritual is directly always connected to some type of religious institution. Now, your faith, your religion can inform your spiritual care, and it should if you're a person of theistic faith, but even an atheist can be spiritual. Even an atheist, and when I mean the word atheist, I mean someone who has no belief in God, even they can be moral. So being spiritual and moral doesn't have anything to do with religion. Most of my work is with veterans and first responders and leaders who really carry experiences that have unsettled their moral world. And so I serve as a clinical chaplain. I also teach at Oral Roberts University on moral injury, but my primary work is companioning people through moments when identity felt fractured. And I'm less interested in diagnosing the pain than I am in helping them recover meaning and purpose for their life. Listen, everybody has problems, Lisa. But you show me someone who's connected to purpose, and I'll show you someone who has the ability to walk through problems almost like they don't exist. So a lot of what I write and I teach grows out of those conversations. The work isn't theoretical to me. It's not just academic. It's been formed in real rooms with real people who are trying to make sense of what they've lived through. And, what really brought me to this work is I come to this work because I encountered the limits of my own language in my own life. Like dealing with unseen wounds, I didn't have the language for that. And there were experiences could not categorize as trauma alone. Like when I went to the VA for help and I was suffering from a moral injury, nobody even knew what that was. They kept trying to tell me, you got PTSD, you got PTSD. And I'm like, yeah, I do, but this isn't what I'm suffering from. And so when there was those experiences that I couldn't categorize as trauma alone, they felt moral. Then they felt like they altered how I saw myself. And so what I realized is many others were carrying similar fractures like me without the vocabulary to describe them. So I began, what began as like a self-help, I began to search for language of my own suffering. And it became like a commitment to presence, which then turned to a commitment for others. I served in military context and I continue to serve in healthcare settings. And in both, I've witnessed how moral conflict accumulates when it remains unspoken. And that observation alone has shaped my direction more than any single event. And look, this is very personal for me, in the sense that no one studies moral injury from a distance. You encounter it in others, and then you eventually recognize elements of it in yourself. And so I try to be careful not to make my story the center. Maybe we'll talk about that one day. My morally injurious event that really kicked this off. But the work matters because of the people I serve, not because of what happened to me. And I think that's that beautiful part of being able to carry the wound and notice that you just want to serve people. I think there's something about caring for other people that connects to purpose and meaning around your own suffering. And it starts to make you realize, some people will be like, well, there's a reason I went through this. You hear that all the time. There's a reason I went through this. And maybe that is the reason. I don't know. But most people don't talk about it because it feels like a personal failure. But once you start to talk about it, you realize it wasn't a personal failure. It's a beautiful story of recovery.
Yeah, so this was such a powerful episode. Thank you so much for being here and for sharing all of this information. I thoroughly look forward to the next few that are coming up. Because I think a lot of people listening today, they have learned the lesson of the language for something that they've been carrying really quietly for years. So to our audience, if this episode resonated with you, don't worry, you're not broken. You're just human. And naming the wound is the beginning of healing it. If you would like to learn more about Dr. Carter Cech or his book, Healing in the Wild, all of his information will be in the show notes for you. And share this episode with someone who might be carrying something silently. I can't wait to see you guys next time. Take care, everyone.